Supreme Court, 214, BP versus Patterson. Are both parties ready? Just a reminder, you have to keep track of your own time, and please state your name when you start your argument. Proceed.
Rachel Yates, appearing on behalf of BP Amoco. BP seeks reversal on two grounds. The first is that the trial court and the Court of Appeals erred as a matter of law in adopting class-wide presumptions on the doctrine of equitable tolling. The second pertains to the chronological scope of the defined class. I'm going to focus my comments on the first issue, unless your questions direct me otherwise. What I want to do at the outset is look at the big picture here. The royalty owners must prove the defense of equitable tolling. Otherwise, all of their claims have already been determined to be barred by the statute of limitations. Equitable tolling is not a favored defense in the law. And this court has said that the trial court must examine the specific facts and circumstances of each case and find that all of those elements have been clearly shown. So we have that on the one hand. On the other hand, we have a request to certify a class, which is not our normal way of handling individual disputes. So Rule 23 specifies additional requirements that must be met because we are not proceeding on the specific facts and circumstances of each case, but on common proof alone. The only way that the trial court and the Court of Appeals could marry those inconsistent approaches of how we proceed is to create inferences or presumptions. Those inferences and presumptions cannot be right because the effect of that is either that the royalty owners no longer have to prove three of the five elements on equitable tolling, or if they do prove them or we rebut them, then we now no longer have predominance or superiority under Rule 23. The two are simply incompatible. Tolling is the primary dispositive issue in this case. We have a strong public policy in this state favoring the avoidance of litigating stale claims in favor of statute of limitations. BP has already met its burden of proof on the statute of limitations. This is not a case in which perhaps some class members might be affected by a statute of limitations argument, in which some class members might need to show equitable tolling. This court's ruling on statute of limitation applies to each and every class member. And unless each and every class member can establish equitable tolling through fraudulent concealment, their claims are barred. As a result, I think it's proper to look then at the elements of their tolling claim, not because we're asking them to prove it on the merits at this point, but simply to know the types of evidence that needs to be adduced. The royalty owners spend much of their brief pointing to BP memoranda from the early 1990s in an effort to show that there was some conspiracy to defraud the royalty owners. BP will defend against that vigorously at the trial on the merits, but it has not needed to do so here because BP acknowledges that its conduct was common as to all of the royalty owners. But that doesn't take the royalty owners far enough in their proof on fraudulent concealment. What BP considered internally as it was deciding to roll out this new accounting system in 1993 made no difference to the royalty owners. And let me give you an example of that. We have in the evidence the testimony of Donald Kanzler, who was a former named plaintiff. Mr. Kanzler testified that as of 1976, he believed that the division orders identifying a netback methodology were inconsistent with his lease and that he was being paid incorrectly. For personal reasons, he chose not to proceed or to challenge that. He sat on his rights, and so he will be unable to establish his ignorance, his reliance or action on some information from BP, or that we posed an impediment. That's 1976. Now we jump forward 15 years to when these BP memoranda were written. Can we assume that somehow Mr. Kanzler, in the interim, sprang into a state of reliance on something that BP was doing at that time? The check stubs never changed. The information that he received never changed. So how could we possibly believe that those internal memoranda, of which he had no knowledge, suddenly changed his perspective, his knowledge, and his motivations? They don't. Three of the five elements are independent of BP's conduct: the ignorance, reliance or action, and the impediment to filing a timely lawsuit. And I note also that the tolling will only last for each royalty owner so long as all three of those elements remain in place, meaning it may change as people gather more information over time. If this court were to follow the ruling of the lower courts and give an inference solely on the basis that BP did not disclose, and therefore the royalty owners did not know about the netback methodology, then we have done nothing but water down the doctrine of equitable tolling.
Excuse me, Jace.
Yes.
Judge Bayless made a specific finding that's a little, he says it's undisputed that BP has engaged in a systematic scheme to conceal the material facts from the class. That's pretty strong language. So it's a little more than sort of not giving them notice.
I'm sorry, it's a little more than?
Not just giving notice.
Well, again, that...
So wait a second. So, and he finds predominance on that basis, really. And then he outlines specific things that are common to the entire class. So, what's wrong with that in terms of certification at this stage of the proceedings?
What's wrong with that is that BP's conduct pertains to only two of the elements of equitable tolling. And so even if you were to find that there was some horrendous scheme on the part of BP, that doesn't tell us
what the
motivations of the royalty
are. I don't think it's we're not finding anything. It's Judge Bayless that made the findings, and he seemed to find that there was a systematic, deliberate scheme to conceal. Fraudulent concealment is what I think he is clearly saying. He made that as a factual finding, so we have to accept that. So that's a given, right?
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
Why not?
Two reasons. First of all, the findings of the trial court came in a 35-page order that recounted verbatim the proposed order of the royalty owners, the one that they tendered. And therefore, findings that came in the trial court's order that may have been used on appeal are subject to heightened scrutiny under the Coors case, as we've cited. But the second is that the only way that the courts below got to the point that they did was to say, we'll make a finding that BP's conduct was common to all, and we'll draw inferences that the other three elements can be inferred. And so we create an inference on their burden of proof, but focusing on only two of the elements that pertain to BP's conduct. I think we see that most clearly in the reliance element. We saw direct evidence contradicting that inference, that the named plaintiffs, some of them didn't even look at their check stubs except to look at the bottom line. They weren't looking for a netback calculation. Some of the class members are also the royalty owners. They receive royalties, but they also pay royalties because they're oil and gas companies. They were paying on a netback methodology, as we were. They were being sued for paying on a netback methodology. The concept that those companies relied on our check stubs deciding not to file a lawsuit against BP for paying on the same wages that they were paying doesn't make any sense. The inference isn't appropriate. But here's the one where I think is very poignant, And it's based on the expert testimony from the royalty owners. They used Donald Fenn to do a calculation of what royalty owners were paid over the 11-year class period. And they determined that 70% of the class members received less than $5,000 in royalties for that 11-year period. Now, keep in mind that the deductions on that $5,000 was even smaller, pennies on the dollar in some cases. And they wanted to establish that because these claims are in many instances de minimis, without a class device, most of these people will not sue on their own. And that's our class experience, that when claims are very small, people say life's too short, it's not worth the effort, it's not economic. This case turns that very principle on its head, because they need to establish their tolling defense, which is, had they known, had they had all these facts, they would have sued. That their motivations were to sue, but they did not. They relied on something we gave or some lack of information in their decision not to bring a lawsuit. What we know, though, is that for most of them, the motivation was not, a lack of information. The motivation would have been, it's not worth it to sue over $5 or $100. And so, without an individual inquiry into why each royalty owner sat on their rights, we will never know. The Court of Appeals had said that it was only a handful of royalty owners that had disputed the issue. But how do we know whether it's a handful or a handful times 500 if we don't question each royalty owner as to their motivations? What happens, I think, when this presumption is given is that we end up with one of two options at trial. Here's how this plays out. The first option is that, consistent with Morrison versus Goff, BP or the royalty owners must come forward with specific facts and circumstances of each case so that the trial court can make a tolling determination. That means that BP conducts discovery of the royalty owners, it takes depositions, it gathers their documents, and then it presents that information royalty owner by royalty owner. If that happens, the predominance and superiority elements of Rule 23 have gone by the wayside. We no longer satisfy that. The second option, and I think the one that is more probable, is that BP is foreclosed from conducting discovery of the class members, and so must go forward solely on the basis of proof that is common to all of the named plaintiffs. In that situation, the royalty owners have successfully skirted the Morrison versus Goff requirements of clearly showing all elements of this unfavored tolling defense. And because BP has now been prevented from doing the discovery it needs, the presumption or inference that's given becomes irrebuttable. That's the problem with trying to allow class certification in situations where three of the five elements are subjective.
How are the royalty owners notified of a change in methodology to calculate the royalties?
It varies.
Well, what happened in this case?
For example, some royalty owners wrote to the company and questioned, how are my royalties being calculated? And we have in the record exchanges of correspondence in which we specifically identified, here's how your processing deduction is being calculated or other deductions. So that's one method. We also had a royalty owner hotline, and that telephone number was printed on every check. We know from experience that people did call in to ask questions about how.
But there was no notice when the change was made to all the royalty owners?
When federal pricing stopped being used, and that date varied, that's part of the reason we've got the chronological scope issue. But as federal pricing changed, there was no uniform notice to royalty owners. So we default then to how they may have learned. Either learning from the fact that federal deregulation of wells is occurring, and that's broad-based knowledge, or we have specific facts, circumstances where people are writing or exchanging or having oral conversations about it. There are many ways for people to know, but even apart from knowledge, because this is not a discovery rule case, it's a tolling case, which goes beyond discovery rule. So even if they didn't know, the question is, were they going to sue even had they known? We have 870 royalty owners that got less than $100. And of that, it's maybe, gosh, you know.
Sounds like the perfect case for a class action, though. Generally, people aren't going to go after that.
But not if the question, the dispositive question here is tolling. Were they going to sue? Is that why they sat on their rights, or because they had completely different motivations, subjective motivations for reliance? That's why the vast majority of courts that have looked at this issue have refused to apply inferences on this, on the element of reliance. It is just too subjective why people choose to sue or not sue. And so where we go with this is that we have the vast majority of courts saying we're not going to allow case management considerations to mask what would be the substantive weaknesses of individual cases. Donald Kanzler being a good example of that. Because he's no longer a named plaintiff, may we just assume that what he knew in 1976 no longer applies, that his personal reasons for not suing no longer apply. And I think the danger of that kind of case management approach is particularly profound where the named plaintiffs are hand-picked and, in as in this case, can be substituted at various times of the case. We have a situation where it was impossible to do what Morrison versus Goff said, which is to look at specific facts and circumstances for equitable tolling, and at the same time have a Rule 23 device which says we're not going to look at specific facts and circumstances and we're only going to go forward on common proof. Those two cannot be wedded, and any attempt to use an inference creates thorny problems that don't solve the problem. They either eliminate an element of proof, or they defeat the purposes of Rule 23. Turning then very briefly, as I'll reserve some of my time, on the chronological scope of the class. There is a significant factual question in the case as to whether BP in fact paid on a netback methodology between 1986, when the class was defined as starting, and 1993. We have some testimony in the record from Mr. Fend that BP began paying on the netback methodology in 1986, and it did start for some royalty owners on that date. But Mr. Fend's conclusion that it applied across the board was simply wrong and not supported by the evidence. So we view that the trial court erred, abused its discretion, given that there was that this was not supported by the record. Mr. Fenn conceded that he'd seen some representative data, but he had very limited information. He relied on 4 sample months that we had given him, 2 from 1986 for Mr. Patterson and 2 from 1991 for Mr. Patterson. The 2 from 1986 actually demonstrated that he was being paid on federal pricing at the time, not a netback. Mr. Fenn apparently ignored those and looked only at the 2 sample months from 1991, and then concluded that apparently all royalty owners were paid on a netback for the entire period from 1986 forward. John Smith, however, who was also BP's expert and an employee from the period at issue, explained that, to the contrary, although 1986 was the first date that it could have started that way, that actually BP did not change everyone over to a netback methodology until 1993, when all federal pricing had ended. And Mr. Fenn admitted, well, that there were multiple methods used at different times, but he would need to determine whether deductions were taken, and he had not done so yet because it would require too much analysis. The need for proof of an injury under the LaVerenz decision stands very starkly here as a point that they cannot satisfy. Between 1986 and 1991, there is no proof that all royalty owners were paid on a netback methodology. Without that proof of an injury, they cannot proceed as a class. So we would ask that the court reverse on both counts, and I will reserve the remainder of my time.
I am George Barton, appearing on behalf of the respondent plaintiffs. I want to start out and really focus on the primary issue that is before the court, and that is whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in determining that each of the six requirements for certification of a Rule 23b3 class have been satisfied in this case on both the class members' claim for breach of the applicable royalty agreements and their claim for equitable tolling of the statute of limitations. And the procedure that was followed in this case, I think, is somewhat important. There was extensive briefing by both sides on the plaintiff's motion for certification of a Rule 23b3 class. And after that briefing was completed, the trial judge conducted a two-day evidentiary hearing on the class certification motion. And at that hearing, the plaintiffs actually called six witnesses as six live witnesses to testify at the hearing. And BP did not elect to call any live witnesses, but BP did submit some documents and some excerpts of deposition testimony. After all of that evidence had been presented, Judge Mays evaluated that evidence. He utilized the preponderance of the evidence standard that had been articulated by the Court of Appeals in Jackson versus Unocal. And he determined, based on his evaluation of the evidence, based on a preponderance of the evidence, that every single one of the six requirements for certification of a Rule 23b3 class had been certified on both the breach of contract claim and the equitable tolling claim. And he evaluated BP's evidence as well of the individual issues. So he made a careful evaluation of the evidence. And the findings that he made, I respectfully submit, were based on very substantial common evidence that the plaintiffs presented. There was a common obligation under the applicable royalty agreements of BP to incur all the costs necessary to deliver the gas to the commercial market. There was a common method that BP employed that had common impact on all of the class members with respect to its method of gathering the gas, processing the gas at the Spindle and Wattenberg plants, and marketing the gas at the tailgate of those plants and selling the gas. There was a common method employed by BP based upon the evidence that was presented from January 1st, 1986 to the end of December 1997 with respect to how BP calculated and paid the royalties, where BP consistently deducted the marketing costs from the selling price of the gas in calculating and paying the royalties. There was a common method employed by BP in terms of the monthly royalty reports that BP sent to the members of the class, in which repeatedly, consistently, and persistently throughout the entire class time period, BP repeatedly sent the class members monthly royalty statements, which represented that the royalties were being paid on the total value, when in fact the royalties were not being paid on the total value, but instead there were very substantial marketing costs being deducted from the selling price in the calculation and payment of royalties.
Counsel, can I stop you there just and ask you to respond to the argument that the other side is making, which is that that very well may be true, that everybody was getting the same sort of information, and you're claiming that that was fraudulent. But the differences come in how that individual royalty owner would react to that information. I mean, maybe some of them were, I guess the argument is, were using the NABBAT method and thought it was perfectly fine, so wouldn't have taken action for that reason. Maybe other people did inquire, actually, and called the hotline or did whatever, so they were either suspicious or had some problem with that. So I guess I'm wondering if you can focus in on how do those differences not preclude a class?
Well, what the evidence in fact was is that the royalty owners were consistently never informed that these deductions were being taken. But when the royalty owners, through involvement in other litigation with Kerr McGee, who was a successor in interest to BP Amoco, learned that these sort of deductions had been taken, which was years later, it was in 2003. Within 2 months thereafter, they filed this lawsuit. So the fact of the matter is that when the royalty owners found out, they acted promptly. So once they found out, the experience of the named plaintiffs was they took action. In the class action litigation, Justice Ida, that was over on the western slope of Colorado in La Plata County, when those royalty owners in La Plata County, in what ultimately led to the Perry litigation, they were told by BP Amoco that they were taking these deductions. What followed? A class action lawsuit followed that was filed in May of 1994. And they pursued that vigorously on behalf of the entire class. The case was finally settled for $100 million. The point is, based on the evidence, the only fair inference is that if they had told them, they would have done something about it. That's what the fair inference is. That's why, in 1990, when BP's committee of its own employees met, they made a recommendation. They had three employees that were charged with the responsibility of determining whether or not BP should change the royalty reports to disclose the marketing cost deductions that we're talking about, that this is the subject matter of this litigation. This committee of three employees that was based out of Houston, I believe, they unanimously recommended to BP's management change these royalty statements and disclose the marketing cost deductions. Why? The reason was that making full disclosure was in accordance with BP's commitment to its corporate value of integrity. That's what the memo says. It's right here in evidence. It's part of the record. But there was a downside to it. They said that you should disclose these deductions, but there was a downside. The downside was, and that's in the memo too, there's increased risk of royalty underpayment litigation. So they were faced with a decision point. You know, do what the committee's recommending or not. And the decision they made shortly after this memorandum was prepared that was unanimously recommending that they change the royalty reports to disclose the deductions, the management decided not to do it, to forestall the royalty or the class members' initiation of royalty underpayment litigation. Because they realize if you disclose these marketing cost deductions, we're going to get sued. So that's why they didn't do it. And that's exactly, if you look at Judge Gabriel's opinion by the Colorado Court of Appeals, he said that it's particularly appropriate to certify a class involving a common scheme of fraudulent concealment, particularly where the scheme is dedicated to achieving the very result that the scheme is all about, which is to forestall the initiation of royalty underpayment litigation by the royalty owners. And he cited a number of cases where that principle has been employed.
What's the duty of disclosure based on?
The duty of disclosure is based on a number of things. First of all, that they're positively representing in these royalty reports that the royalties are being paid, Justice Hobbs, based on the total value. Okay. So it's got to be, in order to make, you know, that statement not misleading, they need to disclose the cost deductions, which they were acutely aware where it was material information. I mean, that's clear from this memo, that's clear from this whole evaluation process that they were making in 1990. And it's also clear from the fact that when they did disclose it to these royalty owners in La Plata County, Colorado, on the western slope, they took action and immediately objected to it, immediately filed class action litigation, and moved forward. And in that case, it was ultimately adjudicated.
It was a breach of contract case.
Yes, it's the same royalty agreements, the same type of royalty agreements, the same type of post-production cost deductions. It's a parallel case to this one. Okay. Absolutely. The other thing that I might add is that, you know, this notion that somehow this is some sort of aberrational departure from Colorado law in allowing the elements of reliance and ignorance to be proved by circumstantial evidence for all the class members is simply not correct. I know it was referenced in the Garcia argument earlier today. The Colorado, this court has repeatedly recognized that in a fraud case, elements of the fraud claim can be proved by circumstantial evidence, indirect evidence. And the Kopagan case speaks specifically to that, as does the earlier Morrison case. And those cases were actually relied upon in a case called Elk River by the Colorado Court of Appeals that was a class action case, where the Court of Appeals actually reversed the trial court for failure to follow Kopagan and Morrison in a class action setting. So not only is there Colorado precedent demonstrating that those elements can be proved through circumstantial evidence, and that an inference of those elements can be established through circumstantial evidence. That's well established under Colorado law.
Even assuming that principle exists and that we would adopt it, how does that explain the factual situation here? We have a named plaintiff who, in fact, it appears did not actually rely because they didn't actually read these documents.
Actually, the named plaintiffs, I want to correct the record.
Okay.
The testimony of the named plaintiffs at the class certification hearing was that they did read the monthly royalty reports that they got. They read them, they received them. Where the confusion came was that they didn't always read the periodic brochures. There were also royalty brochures that purported to also give some explanation about how the royalties were calculated. Those were sent very sporadically, perhaps not more than once or twice during the entire time period that these royalty owners were receiving royalties. But every single one of the named plaintiffs who testified, they all testified that they received, you know, that they read the monthly royalty reports and reviewed them.
So it's on that basis that this inference is appropriate here, you're saying?
Well, it's appropriate for a number of reasons.
But it's appropriate class-wide?
Yes, that plus all the other things that I've talked about. The fact that when the named plaintiffs did learn about these deductions, they acted promptly to initiate litigation. When other royalty owners found out about these deductions, they acted promptly to initiate litigation against BP. So there's a multitude of different items of evidence that prove these elements, I would suggest.
What do you think about counsel's argument that the class is drawn so broadly it includes many people who, let's not say de minimis, but would have very small interest in that, and they wouldn't rely in the same way or be motivated not to file as a result of their reliance?
Well, I think Justice Coates that it's pure speculation to suggest that, but I certainly understand that it is certainly true that there are some royalty owners who have relatively small claims. There is no question about that. But, you know, I think that what the evidence that is in the record demonstrates is that when royalty owners learned about these deductions, they disputed them. With the experience that we have with the named plaintiffs in this case is when they learned of the deductions, they took action and filed litigation. When the royalty owners in La Plata County learned of the deductions, they disputed them and they took action. That's the evidence we do have. You know, the speculation about what a particular royalty owner might have done because of the size of his royalties is nothing more than speculation. And I will tell you with respect to the hearing, that there was no evidence that was presented by BP in terms of a witness who came forward and testified that, well, if I'd known about it earlier, I wouldn't have done anything. They had an opportunity to present that evidence. but there was no evidence whatsoever presented at the class certification hearing to that effect.
Is there any other precedent that this equitable tolling doesn't have to go case by case? Remind us if there is.
Oklahoma Supreme Court case, 2008, equitable tolling, same sort of situation in the Moscot case, it's cited in our brief, the Barrichello case. Some of the other state court cases, Justice Hobbs, are equitable tolling, but they're fraudulent concealment cases.
Okay.
The real emphasis of the case law, as I would say, is that generally speaking, where you have a common fraudulent scheme where material facts are being concealed, the courts have generally held that certification in that circumstance is warranted. I would say as a general principle that's true, or certainly the vast majority. Now, I understand there's a wide variety of class certification decisions out there in other jurisdictions, but that's generally been the holding. And certainly the Koch case and the Baum case out of Ohio also emphasize that on the state court level.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but is that series of case law, is it draw any distinction between where the underlying claim is a fraudulent concealment claim as opposed to fraudulent concealment as being necessary to prove equitable tolling?
Well, in the Squad case, as I recall, was specifically an equitable tolling case. So, yeah, I think that case is equitable tolling. I think there are other cases out there that are also equitable tolling that. But essentially, I would say that that there's really not a distinction drawn per se, because you've got the same basic elements for fraudulent concealment and equitable tolling. The elements are very similar. Well, one thing I will say is that, you know, this court, and one of the things that it's emphasized in terms of allowing equitable tolling is that the entire theory of equitable tolling is, and this is in the Dean Witter case, is that a defendant, quote, should not be permitted to benefit from his or her own wrongdoing. That's been the emphasis in this court's own decisions. I mean, that's the whole concept of equitable tolling is that the defendant's wrongful conduct.
Sounds like a general exemption from the statute of limitations is what you're arguing, because it's a fraudulent scheme.
That's correct. That is correct. And really, I mean, the case law, I think, is, I mean, there's not a huge body of case law, Justice Hobbs, but you have First Interstate Bank, Morrison versus Goff, the Dean Witter case. I mean, there's quite a number of decisions that this court has issued that have recognized that doctrine. And I think in this case, I would respectfully say that the evidence in this case is particularly well suited to apply that doctrine. And that's, you know, what the trial court determined after all the evidence was evaluated at the class certification hearing. And that's why the Court of Appeals evaluated the same evidence and determined that that was an appropriate ruling and was not an abuse of discretion. Before I move on to, I'm going to move on to a couple of other subjects that I'd like to deal with on this subject matter. One thing is that I want to make clear that in terms of the evidentiary requirement here, the plaintiffs did not seek a presumption of reliance. What they sought was, and what the plaintiffs argued was, that there was sufficient circumstantial evidence to establish the elements of reliance and ignorance on a class-wide basis. And I think in this case in particular, that's warranted, because you had, as we've talked about, a common monthly royalty report that never deviated, that consistently, you know, told the royalty owners they were being paid on the total value when they were not, consistently concealed and did not disclose these marketing cost deductions. There was a conscious decision made by BP not to disclose the marketing cost deductions, even when their own employees recommended that they do so. And there was virtually, I mean, the evidence, the individualized evidence that BP presented was virtually de minimis. As the Court of Appeals put it, it was evidence related to only a handful of royalty owners, and much of that evidence didn't really directly address the post-production cost issue in any event. The evidence...
The distinction you're making between an inference and a presumption, let's assume we affirm I should have said Judge Nay's earlier, but Judge Nay's opinion is certifying class. How does that work, the next step? And what's the difference in your position about the inference? Evidence of circumstances indicate evidence of fraud as opposed to, say, a rebuttable presumption?
Well, I think that, I think, Justice Bender, what you have in this case is you have evidence that been presented at the class certification hearing that the named plaintiffs themselves were never informed of these deductions. There was evidence that BP never took any steps to inform any of the class members about the deductions.
So the class evidence is a preponderance. We got that. So now what's the next step?
All right.
And how does the reliance or the rebuttable presumption or the inference that you were arguing for, how does that play in?
It plays in with
the class-wide proof.
Class-wide proof because there was no disclosure by BP of the cost.
I mean next step. Next step, yeah.
Well, when the case is tried,
yes,
we present our evidence demonstrating that the named plaintiffs were never informed of, had no knowledge of these deductions until shortly before until they found out about it in connection with other litigation, that shortly after that, they commenced the litigation, that there's no evidence that any of the other class members were informed by any other source that these deductions were being taken. And that based upon that circumstantial evidence and the evidence of the La Plata County wealthy owners that I've talked about, it's reasonable for the jury to conclude that all the class members were ignorant of the cost of these marketing cost deductions and that all of the class members relied on the information that was concealed in not pursuing litigation.
So you get by halftime, but you don't get an instruction on presumption. Is that basically what you're saying?
That, I'm sorry.
You get by at halftime, but you don't get an instruction on presumption, on the presumption.
I don't think that we get an instruction of presumption or reliance. We would say that the instruction would be that the plaintiffs in the class are required to prove their case, but they can prove it by circumstantial evidence. They can prove the elements of equitable tolling by circumstantial evidence, which is consistent with Kopech and consistent with Morrison, and consistent with a number of other jurisdictions.
How is it consistent with what you were saying earlier, though, about it being pure speculation that the people with the really small claims may or may not have chosen to sue? I mean, that was sort of concerning because if, in fact, those people may have not chosen to sue and they're all part of the class, how could we make that kind of differentiation and still certify a class?
Well, I think, Justice Rice, that when I say it's pure speculation, there was no evidence presented that any member of the class would not have objected to these marketing cost deductions.
Right.
That would not have taken steps to dispute it.
Mm-hmm.
And the evidence that we do have is...
And then the step that the chief has been concerned about is that next step, which is then how do we go to say that they would have sued? And you say, well, we look at these two little groups, the Western Slope folks and others, and they did.
That's
and
right.
So and now my question is, but how is that consistent with what you were just saying, which is, but it's speculation whether these people with really de minimis claims would have.
Well, I'm asking,
assuming that they're members of the class.
That this was material information that if it had been disclosed to the royalty owners, that the royalty owners would have acted on it. I'm saying that it's speculation to suggest that any particular royalty owner would not have taken issue with these marketing cost deductions that were being concealed. I understand that you don't have direct testimony, you know, from every class member as part of the class certification record, but based on the testimony that was presented, both the trial court and the Court of Appeals concluded that you could prove on a class-wide basis these elements by circumstantial evidence, which is entirely consistent with Kopechan, Morrison, and Elk River, I might add.
Oh, let's assume some members, that they minimize people, opt out for a second. They have that right.
They do.
What's their defense on a class-wide basis? But what defense can they present?
You mean BP Anika?
Yeah, I do.
Well, I think BP Anika would have the option of presenting that the class members, you know, they can try to present evidence that the class members should have known, or should have known of that we were taking these deductions, and that they didn't act reasonably in you know, failing to discover the deductions, even though the plaintiffs are claiming that the deductions were being intentionally concealed. So I think there is evidence that they can present and would attempt to present, you know, at a trial on the merits. And I'm speculating as to what their defense might be.
And they would then go ahead and say, and despite these people who did sue, there are others who would not have sued, and perhaps put those people on? Is that what you're thinking as well?
I can't speak for BP's defense, but it's possible, certainly.
I mean, I understand there's a lot of difference between what happens on the merits and what happens with respect to the class certification itself, but I mean, at some point those kind of intersect, and that's what we're trying to explore today. But is that of some concern to you or not?
Well, I think that I'm not positive what BP would present, but from what I've seen, you know, it's our view that the evidence that BP had with respect to any class member question or class member communication, it was actually put in evidence. And this was not a selective array of what evidence BP has. This was all of it.
Let me ask you a question in a totally different area.
Yeah.
Just assuming that you were here this morning for that Garcia case, do you think the two courts of appeals decisions are just totally inconsistent, or are they reconcilable?
We addressed that in our brief, Justice Rice. I think that and the Court of Appeals also addressed it, and we agree with Judge Gabriel's analysis of that in the, I mean, in our case, you know, we did not have a presumption of reliance. We had an inference of reliance based on circumstantial evidence. In addition to that, we didn't have any of these face-to-face communications that were present in Garcia, and I don't know the facts in Garcia perhaps as well.
I think there's a difference, though. I think the Chief mentioned this, between a presumption and an inference.
I do think there's a difference, yes. I think that, I mean, we're not...
What's the difference, other than an instruction, right?
Well, I think that...
We all know that juries don't follow instructions, but...
I think when, you know, we are proving our case through circumstantial evidence of the facts that we have with respect to the named plaintiffs, the facts that we have with respect to no disclosure to any of the class members by BP in any of the monthly royalty reports or any other communication to the class members. Based upon that circumstantial evidence, it's a fair inference for the jury to conclude that the class members as a whole were ignorant of these cost deductions, and that because these deductions are very material, that they relied upon those deductions in not taking action against BP. And we have the countervailing situation, which is that when royalty owners do find out about these deductions, they take action.
Let me come at it from a different angle, because I think I'm understanding what you're saying. You're saying you're just going to prove this up by just classic circumstantial evidence. Nothing new, nothing unusual about it. And people, when they're presented with circumstantial evidence, they can treat it as they wish. They can make any inference they want from that circumstantial evidence, right?
Yes, but also keeping in mind that in this case you have uniform disclosures to class members, you have a conscious decision to conceal the deductions that has common impact on all the class members.
Okay.
And very important, because it's not always the case.
I understand that, and in contradistinction, I suppose, a presumption would have some sort of a shift involved, a burden shifting or a burden of going forward shifting or something. There would be something happening as a result of an evidentiary presumption. You don't think that's appropriate. What you want to do is just simply say, hey, look, let us put on our circumstantial evidence and let the jury figure out what they're going to, but our circumstantial evidence is going to be sufficient for class certification that they would have sued. Is that oversimplifying? Am I wrong? Can you help me, please?
Well, I think it's sufficient in the sense that based on all the pieces of evidence that I've been describing sure. this afternoon, that from that, a jury could conclude that none of the class members knew of these deductions or were informed of these deductions, uh-huh. and that they relied on concealment. They relied on that concealment in not disputing the deductions, which they didn't know about.
The court of
this time is they were found out about.
Sure, the Court of Appeals seems to be using those words, presuming and inferring, somewhat interchangeably, which is maybe what is giving rise to some of these questions. And the decisions seem to treat them differently as well.
I think in this case, the Court of Appeals was fairly explicit in recognizing that in this particular case, it was not necessary to determine the issue of presumption of reliance because the class members can prove their case or the elements of equitable tolling through circumstantial evidence, which would have class-wide implications.
Thank you.
My time is up. Thank you.
I'll start where we just left off, which is the question of what is the difference between an inference and a presumption. And it's one that I struggled with because, in fact, although the trial court referred to inferences, the Court of Appeals referred to both inferences and presumptions. This court in the Benzene case, and I'm not casting aspersions, used the terms interchangeably, inference and presumption. The effect as to BP Amoco is the same because it does shift the burden of going forward.
Why would that be the case if you look at making just inferences from circumstantial evidence as opposed to some sort of evidentiary presumption?
Mm-hmm. At that point, what would happen is that BP would then have the obligation to rebut.
Why would it be an obligation? I mean, I thought the difference was whether it's a burden of persuasion, perhaps. If it's only an inference, it's permissible, it's not necessary. So couldn't BP just rest on that as well and argue that the inference is not sufficient?
I suppose it could.
Well, it may be wiser to do something
exactly.
different. But isn't that precisely where the distinction lies, though?
I think in some respects it is. And what the class device does is that it ties BP's hands behind its back so that it has no option except to try to kind of deal with this in amorphous common terms rather than saying we will rebut that inference by looking at the specific facts and circumstances of each situation.
Well, I mean, but isn't that always the case with circumstantial evidence? I mean, like in a criminal case, you would instruct that the jury can rely upon circumstantial evidence. And in this case, it would be much the same. And whenever there is circumstantial evidence, there has to be kind of an argument back and forth about whether that evidence is good, what contradictory evidence there is. Why would it be any different here?
I don't think it is different if I understand your question. If we were going to run the presumption string out, there would be a presumption given, an opportunity to rebut, and if the presumption were rebutted, the fact finder still could look at the circumstantial evidence to draw inferences from that.
Yeah, I think you're making it worse.
No, you're making it much harder than I'm asking you.
An inference.
But here's the point.
That's circumstantial evidence.
That I want to make is, whether it's an inference or it's a presumption, circumstantial evidence still will come in, and
sure.
royalty owners will be free
but
to
But the way the court would deal with the jury would be very, very different, I mean, as Justice Martinez was suggesting.
I do grant you that. But what I'm saying is that the effect on BP, unless it wants to just throw up its hands and say, well, I guess we're going to live with the inference, the only response that we have to defend the case is to say the inference is not warranted.
So the practical effect, you're saying, is the same.
Well, sure.
Even though they are very different legal effects.
Different legal effects. The reason that we give inferences or presumptions is to benefit the party who does not have control over the evidence. Okay?
That's not right. Circumstantial evidence is always admitted as direct evidence in any kind of case. And really what you're saying is because this is a class action case, we should treat it differently than an individual case. Because we clearly have plenty of case law authority that says on an individual case of fraud you can consider circumstantial evidence. So why is this different?
I'm not suggesting that circumstantial evidence won't come in. What I'm suggesting is that the defendant needs an opportunity to rebut that with either its own circumstantial evidence or direct evidence or opinion testimony, whatever it is. But in a class context, that evidence is taken away from us.
Why? What has been taken away?
Here, the evidence that is critical to this determination are the subjective elements of ignorance, reliance, and an impediment to suing. That information is within the possession of the royalty owners. And if I'm precluded from conducting a royalty owner investigation of what they knew, what their motivations were, whether there was any impediment to them suing or they just didn't want to deal with it, then I have no way of rebutting that except help me if I've got a few pieces of correspondence where someone wrote in and we managed to save it 7 years after we sold the company.
It seems to me you could use the same techniques that they used. Take a sample of the class and show that they didn't care about it because it was too small, for instance, or I read about it or I knew about it. I mean, it's the same argument that they're using to make the class certification, right? So what's available to BP is also available to the plaintiffs.
But then what we've done is say that for the sake of procedural efficiency, we're only going to look at a handful on that side, and we're going to draw inferences that people would have acted one way or another.
Well, isn't that fundamentally the purpose, as Justice Hobbs pointed out, of class action when you have relatively small claims and you have fraudulent concealment over a period of time, and it's for a jury to make a decision about maybe you're right about the equitable tolling, maybe you're not.
But, well, unfortunately, I don't know that it plays out that way, whereas even my esteemed co-counsel would say here is it's pure speculation, these subjective elements of what the motivations were of any given landowner or royalty owner.
It seems to me that the alternative that you would propose, if in fact, under your theory, in an equitable tolling context, ignorance and reliance must be proven on an individualized basis, then effectively, if a defendant is able to interpose a valid statute of limitations defense, a class action could never proceed because you could never prove equitable tolling on a class through class-wide proof. Is that your position? I mean, that seems to be the alternative that you're proposing.
I think it will be a rare circumstance.
What would be the rare circumstance?
Would be allowed. We do have the case of, I think it's Smith versus MCI out of Kansas that's been cited, which was an employment agreement. People were misinformed as to the terms of their compensation, and there was an inference given that had they known the actual terms of compensation, they would not have taken the job. I don't even know if that is necessarily the truth, but you have a much more direct correlation between receipt of information and action on it. Here, we are talking about inaction and the motivations for inaction or inertia in choosing whether to bring a lawsuit or not. And we have seen that from the evidence here that they're all over the board. Although the named plaintiffs, whose royalties were among the highest, did choose to bring a lawsuit, Mr. Kanzler chose not to bring a lawsuit. People who received our royalty correspondence describing the netback methodology chose not to bring a lawsuit. We've got information in the record showing that the John Hill Company, for example, wrote to us and said, if you pay me on any method other than the netback, then I'm going to challenge that. So he clearly knew, and he was saying, I am not going to sue you on that basis. In these other cases that were mentioned, tolling was not an issue. So the fact that you again had maybe a handful of named plaintiffs who felt strongly enough about it to sue doesn't answer that very subjective and speculative question of what did all the other class members feel equally motivated to bring a lawsuit. One of the elements that Mr. Barton said is, as he was kind of going through what their proof would be, is the royalty owners didn't know, BP didn't disclose it, and they were not informed by any other source. What's the basis for that? Unless we ask every royalty owner, how do we know that they weren't informed by some source? We don't know. And if that's all we're going on is we didn't tell them and the named plaintiffs didn't know, then we are back to having a discovery rule in this case, which this court has already told us does not apply. Where equitable tolling has been very strongly stated by this court as requiring a clear showing of all of the elements for the specific facts and circumstances, we simply cannot proceed on a class device that would eliminate those that burden of proof on three of the five key subjective elements of the claim. Thank you.
This will stand submitted on the briefs.